From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the hurdy-gurdy man, Donovan P. Leach, otherwise known as Donovan, whose 1960s hits include Hurdy-Gurdy Man, Mellow Yellow, and Catch the Wind. He has a new box set of his work from 1964 to 2004. Also, writer Sukheta Mehta on Bombay, the city in which he grew up, which also is the subject of his book, Maximum City, now in paperback. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a real find, a 1957 concert recording featuring Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. It's being released for the first time. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow, directed and written by George Clooney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today is Donovan, who's celebrating not only his 60th birthday, but his 40th anniversary as a recording artist. He has a new box set, a 3-CD, 1-DVD affair called Try for the Sun, The Journey of Donovan. In November, he'll also return to the U.S. on tour and publish an autobiography, titled straightforwardly, The Autobiography of Donovan, The Hurdy-Gurdy Man. Hurdy-Gurdy Man, of course, is the title of one of the singer-songwriter's early mid-60s hits. Others include Sunshine Superman, Mellow Yellow, and Wear Your Love Like Heaven, and this song, recorded in 1967.
On my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. The lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is.
As a young folk artist, Donovan was famous for several things, including helping to usher in the psychedelic movement, hanging around with Bob Dylan when Don't Look Back was filmed as Dylan toured England, and being with the Beatles as they went to India to see the Maharishi. Terry spoke with Donovan in 2004. Before we hear their interview, let's listen to Donovan's first recording, a 1964 demo of the Buffy St. Marie song, Codeine.
In my belly's craving, I got a shaking in my head. I feel like I'm dying, and I wish I were dead. If I live till tomorrow, it's gonna be a long time. For I'll reel and I'll fall and rise on codeine. And it's real, and it's a real one more time. When I was a young man, I learned not to care. While whiskey in front of it, I often did swear. My mother and father said whiskey's a curse, but the fate of their baby is many times worse. And it's real, and it's a real one more time.
That's Donovan, recorded in 1964, a demo recording, his version of a song by Buffy St. Marie. So you were pretty kind of folk-oriented at the very start. How did that start to change?
Well, you can hear in my guitar playing that I'm reaching beyond the folk scene. Although I'd begun performing as a folk singer, I was biting into the guitar with my guitar pick, and I didn't realize at first, but what I was trying to do was come up with a kind of a Celtic rock, a kind of a fusion where the pop sensibilities and the blues and jazz as well, I could blend into my folk style. At the same time, I was also writing, of course, poetry. An enormous amount of songs started pouring out, and the jazz that I was listening to in college, Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and essentially Billie Holiday from the jazz world, and the classical music, and the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones, and when Hendrix came along, listening to Jimmy. And the change was not sit down and write a Sunshine Superman album, but out of my songs, I met a producer called Mickey Most, and John Cameron was the arranger. And we began to make that album, Sunshine Superman, which was so eclectic and so experimental, and at least a year and a half before Sgt. Pepper.
Well, since you've just mentioned Sunshine Superman, why don't we hear it? And this is your recording from 1966.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out easy, but I changed my way. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine, I know it. We'll do it in style, 'cause I made my mind up, you're going to be mine. I'll tell you right now, in a trick and a book and a baby, all that I can find. Superman or Green Lantern ain't got nothing on me.
That's Donovan, recorded in 1966. I have a very profound question for you, and that is, where did you get your clothes in the 60s when you were on TV and radio and touring all the time?
We used to go down to the vintage clothes shops, and it was Portobello Road, and Brian Jones, who invented the Rolling Stones, was the first to raid the old velvets and the feathered boas and the and the corduroy jackets and the clothes from a bygone age. But all of us came out of art school, so we were very into the image. And so The Who would dress up in pop art with Targets and Union Jacks. They'd get their clothes made out of flags. Because what the art students are wearing this year, probably a lot of young people will be wearing next year.
Donovan speaking with Terry Gross last year. Let's hear another of his classic hits, Mellow Yellow.
Just mad about saffron. Saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow. About 14, 14's mad about me.
Now, I should apologize in advance for asking you a question you've probably been asked more times than you could care to count. Your song Mellow Yellow, which was a big hit in 1966, a lot of people assume that was about getting high by smoking banana peels. What was the song about?
You know, it was about being mellow. The color saffron is the color of the Buddhist robe, the color saffron. But the name saffron was a girl as well. There's multiple meanings in many songs. But being mellow and laid back is very much a jazz phrase. Be cool, man. You know, don't be so hassle. Just lay back. Could be mellow. But the reference to smoking bananas completely shocked us all at the time. Wonder where anybody got that idea. You can't get high smoking banana peels.
I guess it's then, the line electric banana.
Well, the smoking of the peels, I didn't realize why that had been so tied with my song until 2 or 3 years ago. I was in Cleveland in the Rock and Roll Museum, and I was sitting next to Country Joe McDonald, and we started talking. And Joe said to me, "Hey, man, by the way, it was me." I said, "What do you mean it was you?" "Mellow Yellow, man. And the bananas, smoking bananas." I said, "Joe, I got a feeling that I'm not going to like what you're going to tell me here." "Tell me." He said, "Well, man, in San Francisco, 1966, what we thought was we put the band on the back of the truck and we'd go down to an old yard I know, and it has all these carnival floats that they threw away, and we found this giant banana. and we put it on the truck. We started up the band. We drove down through Hay Ashbury, playing the music, advertising a gig. But just to make sure the people knew we were coming, we announced to the press that you can get high smoking bananas. And he said, that would have been the end of it, but that Friday, you released the single, Mellow Yellow.
Uh-huh.
I said, Joe, thanks, because I've been asked for 35 years. Why do you say you can get high smoking bananas? Because I guess millions tried it, Terry.
Great story.
Electrical banana is gonna be a sudden craze. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow.
I'm so glad you told the story behind that. That clears up that clears up a lot of issues. One of the things you have the distinction of is being the first British pop musician to be busted for smoking marijuana. This was in 1966, which was the same year as Mellow Yellow. What were the circumstances?
Victimization by the drug squad in the establishment to try to stop the free flow of ideas coming through the new revolutionary pop groups, Beatles included, the Rolling Stones. They busted me because I think they thought, well, we'll get him first, and then we'll get the Stones and the Beatles, and then we'll go on to the other ones. And that was so. But it was very clear in the press and to all my friends that it was definitely a victimization. I was fined. I wasn't put in jail. And I was given a caution that I was a voice of youth and that I must take responsibility.
First there is Donovan, then there is no Donovan, then there is. We'll be back with more of Terry's interview with Donovan after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Donovan, recorded last year. He brought his guitar with him, and will rejoin them as Donovan performs an acoustic version of his own Hurdy Gurdy Man.
Thrown like a star in my vast sleep, I open my eyes to take a peep, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing the songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing the songs of love. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Histories of ages past, unenlightened, the shadows cast down through all eternity, the crying of humanity. Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing the songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man, he comes singing the songs of love. Beatles were hurdy-gurdy men, they come singing your songs of love. I am the hurdy-gurdy man, I come singing your songs of love. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang.
Well, thanks for doing that. That's Donovan performing one of his songs from, was it the late 60s?
Yeah, that came from the Hurdy-Gurdy Man album in 68.
Good. Where exactly were you, or what? I know you were in India and studying meditation, but when you wrote Hurdy-Gurdy Man, was there something very specific that precipitated the song?
Well, I was in India, and I was playing guitar with George Harrison in the ashram in Rishikesh, and I'd been developing some ideas of this song, Hurdy-Gurdy Man, and George gave me a dambura, which is the drone instrument in the Indian ensemble. And that's on the Hurdy-Gurdy Man song now, because he gave it to me and I took it back to London and recorded it. The ideas in Hurdy-Gurdy Man come from an amalgamation of and an absorption of so many ideas from spiritual books, and in particular the Diamond Sutra. And speaking of Celtic mythology also, that the bardic Celtic tradition.
You know, I think that that is your most imitated and caricatured songs. Like when people wanted to do a Donovan impression, and when you're famous, that's what people do. They do impressions of you. That's the song I think that they would often choose because of the shake in your voice on that song.
Well, Hurdy-Gurdy Man, to be re-recorded by others, is wonderful because of the lyrical message. But Season of the Witch, another song of mine, seems to have been adopted again and again and again by so many bands because it makes them feel good when they play. And Led Zeppelin used to use my song, Season of the Witch, to warm up every rehearsal before every performance, so Jimmy Page tells me.
Interesting. Do you know why?
It's just two extraordinary chords, A7th and D9th, and it's funny.
Would you just play those chords so we can hear them?
Yeah, I can play them. When we first start playing guitar, when you're a young musician, you get hooked on a phrase or a musical phrase or a set of chords, and this is the set. Now, when you're a young band, and you start playing this, then you realize you're still playing it about 2 hours later. Something must be good about these two chords. But it also allows you to play many different things when you're just vamping and jamming on these two chords. Americans also have recorded it. Dr. John has recorded it for that movie Blues Brothers 2. And also, the Allman Brothers, I think, did my song, The Mountain. But it was Al Cooper and Stephen Stills
right.
Recorded it as well.
Right.
But it's a spooky song, and it actually spoke about being busted before I was busted. One of those prophetic things. Oh, no. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch. That
now,
was Season of the Witch.
Had you heard those two chords together in other songs, or did you hear something in those two chords that inspired you to put them together?
This chord, the D9th, I'd heard from Bert Jansch. Now, it's a very important chord in the world of folk blues and jazz because there's many songs that use it by going Here's the D9th. So it's part of the traditions of jazz and blues. There is a house in New Orleans. It's in there. It's also in Hit the Road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no. It's in many of the blues progressions. And, hey. So it actually is a very established emotional chord in many blues, yeah.
Well, Donovan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Donovan, speaking with Terry Gross last year. He has a new box set collecting his 40 years of music called Try for the Sun, The Journey of Donovan. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Color in sky, Prussian blue, scarlet fleece changes hue, crimson ball sinks from view. Sky rose carmethine, alizari and crimson.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. From Delacorte Press, publisher of Robert's Ridge, A Story of Courage and Sacrifice on Taker Gar Mountain, Afghanistan, by Malcolm McPherson. Additional support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane concert recording from 1957 that's being released for the first time. Also, Suketu Mehta on the city of his birth. He writes, "Bombay is the future of urban civilization on this planet. God help us." And David Edelstein reviews Good Night and Good Luck, the new film about Edward R. Murrow. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Early this year at the Library of Congress, jazz curator Larry Applebaum came across forgotten tapes from a 1957 Carnegie Hall benefit concert. It included a set by pianist Thelonious Monk with John Coltrane on tenor sax. Monk and Coltrane had been working together for months, but this was the first live material to surface by their working quartet. Now that concert recording is out, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, you know you want it.
Shadow Wilson on cymbals and drums, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, yeah, with Monk and Coltrane. In fussing over them, I didn't want to forget Wilson's kick-ass drumming or Ahmed Abdul-Malik's rock-solid bass work. Monk always did like a no-fuss, hard-swinging rhythm section. And did we mention Coltrane's on here? Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane began a long stint at New York's Five Spot in July 1957, 4 months before they played Carnegie. Hipsters knew it was a major event. Monk was at last breaking through to rank-and-file jazz fans, who'd been slow to warm to his elliptical piano style, and Coltrane was a rising star who was between tenures with Miles Davis. Monk and Coltrane recorded in the studio in 57, and there's a live album from a one-time reunion a year later. But this is our first look at the working 1957 quartet live. On first glimpse, the pairing looks odd. Monk, the master of understatement, meets the hyperactive jackrabbit of the tenor. In practice, it was perfect. The pianist left lots of space in the music, and the saxophonist loved to fill space up. It was the best symbiotic relationship since Mr. and Mrs. Jack Spratt sat down to dinner. Some jazz folks, like me, think the way to play Monk's music is to take it on its own spare terms. But Coltrane became one of the great Monk interpreters by doing the opposite. The saxophonist had a genius for playing a million notes and making it sound like something, something more than practice or showing off. In a way, this newly unearthed stuff sounds oddly familiar, because there's other Monk and Coltrane out there, and Monk's late 50s period is abundantly documented. But Coltrane, who spoke warmly of this experience ever after, has never sounded happier or more enthusiastic with Monk. The band accommodates him with a double-time breakout on the ballad Sweet and Lovely. The CD, The Thelonious Monk Quartet with John Coltrane at Carnegie Hall, is a literal find. A look at two giants on the cusp of greater fame, feeding on the differences between them. By the way, that November 1957 benefit concert for the Morningside Community Center also featured Billie Holiday, Ray Charles, Sonny Rollins, Chet Baker, and Dizzy Gillespie, and the priciest ticket would have set you back all of $4. Now you know what Steve Lacy meant when he spoke of New York in the 50s as paradise. ¶¶
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Thelonious Monk Quartet with John Coltrane at Carnegie Hall on the Blue Note label. Coming up, Maximum City, the city of Bombay. This is Fresh Air. The book Maximum City is about the largest city in the world, its enormous movie industry, its organized crime, its religious feuds, and how fundamentalism is affecting politics. The city is Bombay, also known as Mumbai. Author Sukedo Mehta grew up there. He left in 1977 and came back 21 years later to research his book. He spoke to criminals, policemen, prostitutes, and politicians. He even co-wrote a Bollywood musical. Mehta also has lived in London, Paris, New Jersey, Iowa City, and New York, where he is based now. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and The Village Voice. In his book Maximum City, which just came out in paperback, Mehta writes, "With 14 million people, Bombay is the biggest city on the planet of a race of city dwellers. Bombay is the future of urban civilization. God help us." Terry spoke to Mehta last winter.
You describe Bombay as representing the city of the future. What are the characteristics of Bombay that you think represent the city of the future?
Right. I think, Terry, that the 21st century will be dominated by these vast megacities, mostly in the developing world. The United Nations just came out with a report predicting that by the year 2030, 60% of the planet's population will be living in cities. And 2 billion people will be living in slums. Now, there's a group of cities such as Sao Paulo, Lagos, Jakarta, Kinshasa, Bombay, which are composed of, well, the definition of a megacity is more than 10 million people. But these cities have enormous numbers of people constantly coming in from the countryside and living in these vast shanty towns. They're also marked by a kind of breakdown of civic order and a constant low-level strife. So in the case of the Brazilian cities, tremendous influence by the drug gangs over the affairs of the city. And in Bombay, the underworld specializes in extortion, real estate, and film financing. And really, they've become pretty unpleasant places to live for most of the people in it. But these cities also represent hope for the people coming in from the countryside. They're a beacon of hope for the young people in the countryside. And their growth is added to because of the impoverishment of the countryside, because agriculture is less and less viable in these countries. And part of the reason for that is also the enormous subsidies given to agriculture in the developed countries. So it means that a cotton farmer or a wheat farmer in India can't get a fair price for his crops, and his son will take the first train to Bombay and join the ranks of the people in the swelling shanty towns.
You write also about when you were living in Bombay that all around, people asked you for money, your driver, your maid, your friends down on their luck, strangers. How is that different from New York, where at the very least there's no shortage of strangers asking you for money?
Well, the difference is that in New York, we're not very rich. In Bombay, we were very rich because we were coming from New York. So we were at the top of the pyramid. And from all areas, they zoomed in on us. We were like a low pressure system in an area of high pressure. And it got really uncomfortable to have to continuously either bring out her wallet or refuse to bring out her wallet.
So what did you do more often, bring out the wallet or not?
Well, initially we brought out her wallet quite a lot, and we got ripped off all the time in buying the simplest of services, till we realized that it was a form of newcomer's tax. That is, anybody who comes into a city, any city, in the first year will get ripped off. You'll get ripped off if you're coming to New York and you don't have a network and, you know, you don't know which movers to hire, or you don't know where to shop for the cheapest clothes. So for the first year, it was really uncomfortable, and we spent much more money than we should have. But then as we got used to it, we realized there were ways in which we could avoid con games, for example, and know who to trust and who not to. And we discovered the best places to shop for bed sheets, computers, and oregano.
Oregano?
Well, we'd come from New York, and one thing we really missed was Italian food. So we ended up cooking a lot of Italian food at home. And I remember the heaviest item in my luggage going to Bombay was a giant can of extra virgin olive oil.
My guest is writer Sukay Tumeda, and his new book is called Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. He grew up in Bombay and returned there for several years in the late 90s and early 2000s to live and to research this book. Seeing how Muslims and Hindus do not get along famously in Bombay now, and, you know, having researched what happened in the riots and having spoken to Hindus who describe how they killed Muslims, what is your reaction to seeing the growing role that religion is starting to play in American politics?
I lived in Iowa for 3 years, and so I've seen the growing role of the evangelical churches in the American Midwest. And if people say that much of India is a Hindu nationalist country, then by that definition, much of America is a Christian nationalist country. It's not something that, you know, I see as a welcome development, but I also see that for many of those people in the Midwest, their faith really is a reaction to the more troublesome aspects of modernity. That is, they really don't know how to deal with the modern world and its changing values. And it's the same reason people in India turn to the more extreme manifestations of Hinduism or of Islam. Except in India, the trouble really happens in the larger cities, that is, in urban India, not in rural India. You'll hardly ever hear of religious riots in the countryside. And in America, certainly the values crowd seems to be concentrated in, you know, flyover country. The difference between the two countries also is that this spring, India voted out the BJP. This was the party associated with Hindu nationalism. And, you know, they were mostly voted out for economic reasons, but there was also a large section of the country which felt troubled by this increasing involvement of religion in politics. And I must admit that I was hoping that the same sort of thing would happen here, but it hasn't yet. Maybe America needs to experience a few more years of people who want to eliminate the barriers between religion and politics and public life to really know what it feels like to live with such a government.
One of the things you got to do when you were living in Bombay is to co-write a Bollywood musical called Mission Kashmir.
Right.
And how did
they're all musicals.
They're all musicals, yes. How did you get to write for Bollywood?
Well, I wanted to study Bollywood from the inside. Now, I realized early on in my stay in Bombay that, you know, I'd always grown up with Bollywood. I love the movies. And I realized that I couldn't just go around interviewing people. Most of these people are very busy. They have no time for journalists, Indian or foreign. So the only way I could really understand the making of this fascinating industry was to work in it. That is, to follow the construction of desire in these movies from the inside by making myself useful to them. So when a writer friend of mine invited me to come along to a story session that his brother-in-law, a famous movie director, was doing, you know, I came along, and the director started asking me questions when he found I was a writer. And before long, I became part of the script-writing team for a movie called Mission Kashmir, which is a film ostensibly about war-torn Kashmir, but with song and dance.
So you had to show the film to the censor board of India. What are the parameters for censorship in India?
All of these films are very heavily censored to a degree that would be unthinkable in the U.S. That is, you're not allowed to have nudity, you're not allowed to have open sex, you're not allowed to have swear words. So it really stifles cinema in India. And the censor board is really made up of people often who are very ignorant about cinema. They're drawn from the community, that is, respectable middle-class people, somewhat like the Texas State Textbook Commission. So I've actually sat in on meetings of the Indian Censor Board and watched them censor films on political grounds. That is, it would make the police look bad, or it would make the a particular political party look bad. And the country accepts this. So as a result, most of these Bollywood films, and even the South Indian films, they get by on lots of double entendres and innuendo and, you know, the famous wet sari scene in which the heroine will accidentally get drenched in the rain and will dance around with her sari becoming progressively more transparent. It's really quite disturbing when you're trying to get across political ideas which reflect what's happening in the country. And the censor board says that the country is absolutely not ready for this.
Where did the songs come in?
The songs, Terry, I think are the most delightful part of the Bollywood films. And there's a long tradition in India of advancing narrative through music. So you'll find this in the folk theater of the country, in the religious epics, the way they're told. They'll be singing and dancing. And the song isn't, it's not just a diversion from the plot. It actually advances the plot in many ways. And even if it doesn't, it's fine, because people come there to have a complete entertainment, you know. There's a film out right now called Veer Zara, which I'd also followed the making of, which is almost 3.5 hours long. Now, you know, most Americans would be killing themselves if they had to sit through a 3.5 hour film. But for the Indian viewer, you know, he's worked all day in the villages, and in the evening, he really wants value for his money. He wants to sit for 3.5 hours and watch these gorgeous people dance and have troubles and resolve them at the end and have, you know, families reunified. He wants it all. He wants action. He wants a bit of titillation. He wants song and dance. Because, you know, when he goes back, there isn't that much to go back for. So the films are kind of an exaggerated reality. And even the singing, you know, often the singing really escapes logic altogether. There'll be a pair of lovers. They'll be walking down Bombay Street. And the man will look at the woman and start singing, and all of a sudden they'll be magically transported to the alpine valleys of Switzerland. And no one in the audience will blink an eyelid and think, well, this can't really happen.
Saketu Mehta, speaking to Terry Gross in December of 2004. His book, Maximum City, has just come out in paperback. Coming up, David Edelstein on Good Night and Good Luck. This is Fresh Air. Good night and good luck. With those words, Edward R. Murrow closed his famous See It Now broadcast denouncing the anti-communist witch hunts spearheaded by Senator Joe McCarthy. It's also the title of the new movie about Murrow, his network CBS, and what led up to that broadcast. George Clooney directed, co-wrote, and plays Murrow's producer, Fred Friendly. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
At the midpoint of George Clooney's Good Night and Good Luck, CBS chairman William Paley attempts to dissuade Edward R. Murrow and his producer, Fred Friendly, from going on the air with an attack on Senator Joseph McCarthy. In a big oaken office reeking of power, Paley, played by Frank Langella, argues that McCarthy's going to self-destruct anyway. Later, he says that viewers expect objective reporting, not civics lessons. But Paley's case is undermined by the very movie we're watching. Because what Clooney has made is a civics lesson, and a rousing and unapologetically one-sided one, with a melodramatic charge. The villain is not so much McCarthy, dead these 40 years, as a culture in which dissent is punished with innuendo and worse. Good Night and Good Luck is set in 1954. When the tide is turning against the junior senator from Wisconsin and his overweening anti-communist crusade. But TV has yet to go along, and Murrow, played with affecting gravity by David Strathairn, and Friendly, played by Clooney, have had enough of this atmosphere of fear and intimidation. To keep their jobs, CBS employees have had to sign an oath of loyalty to the United States, and local affiliate anchor Don Hallenbach, played by Ray Wise, is being driven mad by a tabloid columnist's relentless charges that he's a pinko. The script, by Clooney and Grant Heslov, doesn't make the point, and maybe should have, that the TV medium often lags behind print in afflicting the powerful, constricted as it is by the interests of its sponsors and the celebrity status of its anchor people. Nor does it tell you that Murrow came relatively late to the anti-McCarthy party. But there's no doubt that his primetime network TV debunking of McCarthy reached a vast public and had a momentous effect. The bulk of the film is set in the CBS studios, and the cinematographer, Robert Elswit, uses high-contrast black and white to evoke both the era and the starkness of the forces in play. The movie feels electrified. It never settles into a loitering pictorial. It has the chain-smoking jitteriness of its protagonist. Cigarettes, by the way, are everywhere, and the way the white smoke curls against the deep blacks is both beautiful and ominous. You don't need to be told that Murrow died of lung cancer. Good Night and Good Luck is a hagiography, a portrait of a journalistic saint who stands up to Paley and a network executive played as a pudgy, complacent weasel by Jeff Daniels. There is no suggestion in the film that some rational people at the time believed that Soviet communism was a threat and that there might have been spies in the State Department. The focus is on the many unjustly hauled before McCarthy's committee, their lives destroyed by hearsay. Clooney has said he made this picture because of unnerving contemporary parallels, like the TV host who declared critics of the invasion of Iraq enemies of the state, or the best-selling author who branded the majority of Democrats guilty of treason. I could tell you more about Good Night and Good Luck, about the moody interludes between acts, smoky jazz numbers sung by Diana Reeves, or the awkward subplot featuring Robert Downey Jr. and Patricia Clarkson as married CBS employees who act as a kind of Greek chorus. But I'll shut up and let Strathairn's Murrow have the last word. From the end of his legendary anti-McCarthy broadcast.
Earlier the senator asked, "Upon what meat does this our Caesar feed?" Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." No one familiar with the history of this country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating, but the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to associate, to speak, and to defend the causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the results. We proclaim ourselves, indeed as we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world, but we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From TIAA Craft, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rapper Emmanuel Jal. He was one of the so-called Lost Boys who fled the war in Sudan. Then he was conscripted as a child soldier by the Sudan People's Liberation Army. Later, he escaped to Kenya. Now, he makes music about peace. His new CD is called Ceasefire. Join us for the next Fresh Air.